Well, I am very pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News, Jane Hammond. Welcome back, Jane.
Thank you.
Last time we were chatting, it was all about you and your career and where you'd been and how you were then saving the world and had in various ways done so. But you were working on a big project called Black Cockatoo Crisis. And you've been working on that. You'll tell us again in a minute, remind us how long you have been, but it's nearing fruition. What's happening? When are we going to see this film?
Yeah, the film has its world premiere on November the 23rd at the Luna Leaderville, and it's in Oxford Street at 6:15 for a 6:45 screening. And we'll be launching the film and the social impact campaign that's wrapping around it to basically save West Australia's southwest cockatoos.
Now, the trailer for the film is out, and people listening to this will also be able to click that on and have a watch and get a feel for it. But start to tell our listeners what Black Cockatoo Crisis is all about and what you're hoping will come out of it all.
Yeah, okay. So Black Cockatoo Crisis is a social impact documentary film. It's a full-length feature documentary made entirely locally, mostly locally. It tells the story of the plight of our three species of black cockatoo in the southwest. The Carnabies, the Bordans, and the forest red-tailed black cockatoos. And all three species are in trouble. And if we do nothing, we'll lose them all within 20 years. So although people see black cockatoos regularly in the city, we're incredibly lucky to see an endangered species. These cockatoos are in trouble. So we see them everywhere and we think they're not, but really they are in serious trouble. Their habitat is just declining at an unprecedented rate.
Those of us who are a little bit older than younger probably remember black cockatoos, and even today the kids see them. You can suddenly be somewhere and a whole lot of black, sometimes white cockatoos descend on a tree and they squawk and make a hell of a lot of noise. And you wonder sometimes whether people just like pretty little blue wrens and they'd be a lot happier with lots more of them and fewer black cockatoos. Why is it we're losing the black cockatoos?
Yeah, look, in terms of pretty blue wrens, these birds are just magnificent. They're big, they're strong, they're so intelligent, they're so full of character. So we stand to lose something that's kind of a little bit like us. You know, cockatoos are like humans in that, and apparently there's been some sort of parallel evolutionary development. There's a book out from Europe called The Parrot in the Mirror that, that sort of traces that lineage or the different way that DNA diverged. I got a bit lost in the question there. Why are they in trouble?
Yeah, why are they in trouble? You've mentioned habitat problems.
Yeah.
We're just cutting the trees now.
Yeah, well, I mean, our Carnabies are big flocking birds. They really love to fly together and gather together. And in that cacophony that you hear in the trees, they're actually communicating incredible amounts of information between the old and the young. Who's going where, what did they see, where's the food? I mean, I don't speak cockatoo, obviously, but that's the gist that you can... Yeah, because you see the flock come in and then you see groups of them leave and you think, well, how are they deciding who goes where? How do they know that they're going to all meet at that roost point tomorrow night? Because the roost points change slightly when they're in an area. So there's this amazing sort of thing going on. If we start to lose, say, our older birds or even our younger birds, then we start to see a loss of those communicative, that cultural knowledge, mm-hmm. That the birds are communicating to one another, that they rely on to maintain a healthy population. Because you look at the numbers and think, well, how can a bird that's got 40,000 be in trouble? But it's much more than just a numbers game. It's a thing called epigenetics, where it's that cultural knowledge the best way of explaining it. So you need a certain population, and no one's quite sure how many for cockatoos, to be viable. And once you hit a tipping point, then basically you lose the rest of the population because they don't have those skills, they don't have that knowledge, they can't find water, they can't find food. So these cockatoos are coming together in the big numbers and communicating, and then they're going out in these smaller groups to nest off the Swan Coastal Plain in the wheat belt. But if you look at the wheat belt, I mean, anyone who's been out there, you can see there's hardly any trees left. So these little pockets that are left are so, so important. And the Carnabies have two of their biggest nesting areas, one at Kokanara up near Ravensthorpe and another at Julimar State Forest. And both those forests are being targeted for so-called green technology minerals. And so once again, we're shoving them on. But there's so little habitat left, there's so little big trees left for nesting hollows that we're really pushing these birds to the brink. And in terms of Carnabies too, we've got the pine plantations north of Perth. And the Carnabies, when that beautiful area of Bankshire, you know, it stretches for 23,000 hectares. It's really huge, the pines, from Nangara, Pinjar and Yanchep. And they're being cleared and not replaced. So right now we've got, there was 23,000 hectares, we've got four left. And the government's hell-bent on getting rid of all those. So these birds are relying on those pine cones for a place to rest and roost and feed up before they fly into the wheat belt, and we're taking that away from them as well.
So how did you decide to make this film? What was it that happened, or did someone come knocking on your door, or did it come somewhere from your heart and mind?
Yeah, when I was making my last film, Cry the Forest, I started, the Cry of the Forest that was named after the cry of the red-tailed black cockatoo that lives in the forest and whose habitat is disappearing at a terrible rate. There's only 10,000 of those left on the planet in the forest red tail. There's other red tails that are less worse off, but these forest red tails that inhabit the forest regions of Perth, behind Perth, are really in trouble. So the cries are just, they're stunning, you know. You've got to stop whatever you're doing and look skyward and spot one, and it's a thrill. And the beautiful red tails and the female with its serrated, or whatever the word is, variegated orange tail, is just like, you couldn't design anything, you know, if you were Picasso, you couldn't design anything better than that, I don't think. So I sort of noticed these birds, and they're really hard to film, and so I didn't get a lot in for Cry of the Forest. I was using different lenses and things. But I started to sort of see something's going on with these birds, because at one point in Cry of the Forest, I'm filming a couple of arrests, and the police were warning one of the guys who was up in a tree, if you don't come down, you're liable for $10,000 fine for stopping work, this important work in logging this forest. Anyway, we hadn't heard anything all morning. We're all camped there. You know, I was camping with the group and filming the goings on. And it had been quite quiet. And then suddenly, as the police were ramping up their messaging, in comes a massive flock of black cockatoos. And there were the Carnabies squawking like anything and flying straight through the middle of everything. And it was spine tingling. And you know, something's going on there. You know, I said to Kelton Pell, who was the narrator of the last film, you know, I was telling him this story, and I said, it's like they knew. And he just turned around to me, because that's his country. He said, of course they knew. They're our ancestors. They know. And I just thought, there's something magic about these birds. And then I was talking to Paddy Cullen, who works for the WA Forest Alliance, and he wanted to start a campaign to save these birds. And the more I listened to him, the more concerned I got. And so I said to him, look, what about if I do you a five-minuter to launch a campaign? So we'll do 5 minutes and tell these stories. But as soon as I started filming, I thought, this is not a five-minute film. These birds, you need to see these on the big screen. You need to engage with them. You need to fall in love with them, and you need to understand them and then act for them. So that's
where it all came from.
That's where it came from. So it grew from, 5 minutes, then I thought, I'll make half an hour, no, 54. And then a few weeks ago, we made a decision, no, it's going to be a full-length documentary feature film, so it can go into cinemas as a whole package. It'll get a theatrical release, it'll have a season, it'll around that will be the impact campaign, and we'll ram home this message. We'll get enough people going to see the film, enough people taking action, contacting their MPs, both federal and state. We need federal changes for better environmental laws, and we need state changes, and all a whole lot of little things that can save these birds, but we're not doing it.
On the technical side, how long has it taken? How many cameras do you have to use to make something like this? What's the process in technical terms to make it?
Well, I do things a little bit differently. I do everything on the cheap, quite frankly, and I just go anywhere. So I started shooting with just a basic lens, and then I thought, I'm not getting the birds close enough, not pulling them in. I was on a Panasonic camera, so I hired a long-term hire of a Canon camera, which is a cine camera with a long, and then I purchased a couple of second-hand lenses to pull the birds in. And then I upgraded with another higher lens to the Panasonic, and suddenly I had a 1-400 mil lens, and they popped, right into the viewfinder, and thought, right, I've got it. So for those close-ups, I use the Panasonic and the Canon and all my interviews. And then I also use an Osmo, which means I can move around really quickly and easily, and it doesn't shake. And occasionally I'd use a GoPro for sticking to the side of the car when I was doing one of the shots about the birds all over the roads, or I'd stick it in a tree where the birds hang out and get some close-ups. So, and then I had a couple of drones as well. So all in all, I hired a Sony for night shooting. So we're up to about 7 cameras there.
I think you've got all of the camera makers coming.
I still hadn't got the shot I really needed, so I brought in Richard Todd, who's made Frackman. He's down in Margaret River, so he came in to help me for a couple of weeks, and we went up to Yanchep, and then he taught me a lot of his skills as well, so that meant I could keep going afterwards. Then I had the help of some amazing cinematographers who had stuff already, who donated, like Simon Cherryman, who's an ornithologist, a brilliant camera person, and who gets up close and personal to the birds all the time. He's got all the licensing. He can shimmy up a tree barefoot. He's, very tall, very athletic, very capable. And so I was able to get those shots that, I could never imagine ever getting.
They're wonderful.
Yeah, so it was a team effort and a lot of cameras.
And when you had everybody in, you mentioned the WA Forest Alliance and Paddy Cullen. I think they won an award recently, didn't they?
They've won so many awards. But most recently it was an UN award, which is pretty stunning.
It is stunning.
Yeah.
And it just shows you how people really care about, the birds are part of a huge ecosystem. Can I ask you this? After you've been sort of sharing all of these spaces with these cockatoos for a few years now, did you develop an attachment for any particular species?
Oh, absolutely. The red tails, they're beautiful. The bowdens are elusive, but the carnabies, oh my goodness, they are so full of character. They are so funny to watch. They're like cartoon characters, and the males especially with the little red eye rings, and they're gorgeous antics. They're just hilarious, and then the language that they're saying, the different pitches, the different things, you worked out that that means let's go now, so off they'd go. This means let look out. This means I'm hungry. This means I'm ready to mate, this sort of thing. So you're kind of watching.
Can you do that sign again?
Chicken arms. But they also splay their tails. The red tails are more, you can see, they signal their intentions much stronger. The Carnabies, they are like people in that they will only breed with the cockatoo that they choose. So they're very particular, and they mate for life. They look after their families, they look after their friends.
It almost sounds to me as if you've learnt some cockatoo dialects in all of this. Did you?
Absolutely. I literally spent a year with the birds. you know, and I got covered in ticks and many, many bites and things later. But I grew to really understand them and find them. Even in the last month, you know, now that I'm finishing the film, I almost feel like I should be now beginning, because I've now got the knowledge that I needed much earlier, and I've finally worked out how to take the camera and picture better. So, but you know, maybe my next film. But no, look, it's been such a delight to be around these creatures.
And from what you've learned, talking about threatened species, and you've mentioned the pine forest just north of Perth and how much has been lost there. I think you said 4,000 hectares left, is that right?
Yeah.
What if you were the emperor for a day, put in charge of all of this, what are the key things you would do to protect these birds?
Mm. Yeah, so I mean, that would be the first and simplest thing. We say, right, there's a moratorium on this 4,000 hectares, because let's not forget these are exotic pines, but the banksias that these birds once relied on so heavily are completely gone in that area. And the government is leaving this land to fallow as wasteland. And you go out there and you can't hear a car, you can't hear, occasionally you hear a gunshot from some, you know, lunatic shooting whatever they shoot. But mostly there's absolutely nothing out there, you know, and it would be, I think, a fairly simple thing to say, you know, okay, we have a pine industry, I understand that, but we have got pine down south. So the government could fulfill its contracts to the local pine veneer company that's up that way and ship in the, you know, and pay the difference. Because really it's a government failing that this has happened. They took out all the pines, they blamed the pines for sucking too much, well, not letting enough water get back into the aquifer for the recharge for the Nangara Mound, but the science behind that needs a review. So I don't think, people I've spoken to, and from what I've seen, it's a bit old-fashioned now, and we should have a rethink of that. But there's a reasons.
There's that area.
Yep.
And what about in other areas?
Areas, the really important breeding areas of Kokanarup and Julimar, which are both targeted by green tech technology companies and both vitally important nesting grounds, those need to be protected. We need to say no. We need to have the right to say no. So we need environmental legislation at the federal level to be much, much stronger. And the federal government itself acknowledges this. They had the Samuel report a couple of years ago that said this is not working.
We're reviewing the Biodiversity Act at the moment, but we haven't seen the outcomes yet. You mentioned green technology. It's an interesting, I'm not sure if it's an irony, but an interesting competition there, isn't it? We're trying to go electric on the planet. We're trying to avoid fossil fuel developments. We're trying to go green when it comes to so much industry. But that can be the risk of the natural environment.
Yeah, but I've got my real doubts about this. I mean, having worked in public relations and worked for the anti-fracking movement, I can almost hear in my head the meetings being held in boardrooms around the world saying, "Hey, let's just tell them it's green, and we'll have too bad. We can go anywhere we like because it's green." Or lithium is, you know, there's an abundant supply right now and people are getting a lot of money out of it, but it seems like it's getting old before it's...
And this is around Ravensthorpe?
Yeah, the lithium mine at the Kokanarup is around Ravensthorpe, and this is the last big stand of big timber for these birds left on the planet. And Julimar Forest as well, that's been targeted for multiple, by Chalice Mining, for multiple minerals, and many of them green tech. So that's a huge one. But, you know, even if we saved one of those, if we saved Kokanarup, because there's enough lithium around in other places, you don't need to dig it up from under a forest that's, you know, got an endangered species hanging by a thread. So we can make these choices and we have to. We can't say we're going to save our climate disaster by... destroying our biodiversity. We need those two issues, biodiversity protection and climate change, need to go hand in hand.
Now, I'm sure there's no one out there who would actually be brave or bold enough to ask this question, but why do the cockatoos matter?
Yeah, well, I guess why does anybody matter? You know, really, isn't it? It's a, one of those philosophical questions. But I think we'd be much, much poorer if we couldn't see a cockatoo. And everyone I've spoken to, pretty much, you know, there are people out there who don't like them messing up their lawn, but when they, you know, chew a marionette, how dare they drop them? You know, but those are the sorts of people who don't like a leaf falling from a tree and messing up their garden. You know, but these are birds that we don't even understand yet, and they're part of our environment. We're so lucky to have them. So yeah, they matter.
If they weren't there, it'd be a damn good sign, wouldn't it, that we're in trouble on lots of other fronts as well?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that the scientists say. If we can't save this iconic and popular bird, what chance is anything else? And if we save, yeah, like they're an umbrella species, so we save the black cockatoo, we save those remaining pockets of habitat, and we save many other endangered species at the same time.
Jane, we'll bring this discussion to a close shortly, but tell me, are you sort of exhausted leading up to the launch? That'll be an exciting night, no doubt. Will be sold out, but people should get their tickets quickly, and we hope it will come to Fremantle as well soon afterwards. We'll raise a petition to make sure that happens. But when it's done, I know that that's not the end of your commitment, but do you have another project in mind already?
Yeah, look, I am working on something very small. Hopefully that's not going to be another feature. But look, these films, they take an enormous amount of energy, enormous amount of money. And for the filmmaker, you know, I've worked for much, much less than the minimum wage for a year, and I kind of can't keep doing that, sadly. So I don't know if I can do another film. But who knows? It's like when you've just had a baby, the first thing people say in the hospital, are you having another one? And you're going, oh my God, you know, can we see this one through? Can we birth it? Can we wait till it's a toddler? And the same with the film, because there's so much now that goes on. When the film's out, I just start a whole new role of how am I going to make this film work to do what it has to do, and that's to save these birds. That's why I'm not going to the ABC with a jolly and so-called both sides of the story. I'm choosing to get bums on seats in cinemas and talk to people personally about what they can do. And that worked for the forest campaign. It worked for Cry of the Forest. We got people in droves knocking on the politicians' doors, people who'd never do that sort of thing before, because they saw the idiocy of what was going on in our forest. And I think if they see this and they see these beautiful birds and they see the peril that they face, they will act.
You explained when we met last time about the theory and the practice behind social impact filmmaking. You're unapologetic about saying this is the problem, this is what we have to do, and you drive just at that. Perhaps we can just finish off by talking about the sort of action you are hoping citizens will want to take on behalf of their cockatoo friends once they've seen the movie.
Yeah, so to contact, basically start planting things in your garden. Rewild Perth, rewild your town, your city, your suburb. Get involved in your local urban bushland group to save what's left of remnant vegetation across the city and across the wheat belt. Get involved in groups like the Wilderness Society and WA Forest Alliance, who have supported this film and will use it in their campaigns. Get involved in the forest management plan that's out for public comment at the moment. Get involved in submissions to say enough of our cover, enough of South 32, they've taken enough of our forests, time's up, guys. So yeah, to get involved like that. But look, the film is social impact, but it's not didactic. You'll see the stories from the points of view of the birds, from the points of view of the people who are at the coalface. I didn't go to government, I didn't go to Alcoa, I didn't go to Chalice Mining or the mob down in Ravensthorpe that want to take that lithium out. I'm speaking on behalf of the birds rather than the shareholders who got plenty of time and can make their own video if they so wish.
Well, on that wonderful note, we'll invite everybody to make sure they get along to the launch and the other showings of the film and hear the cockatoos crying for themselves.
Fantastic.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.